bridge faces off across from the Victory Hotel, so the Farang phalanx can drink itself stupid and watch to see if any new foreigners of interest have washed up on the shores. There are other lower dives for those sailors who manage to pass customs and quarantine and wash down, but it is here, with the snapping white tablecloths of the Victory on one side of the cobbled street, and Sir Francis's bamboo slum on the other, where those foreigners who settle in Bangkok for any length of time eventually sink.
"What were you shipping?"
Lucy asks again, prodding Coyle to explain his losses. Coyle leans forward and lowers his voice, encouraging all of them to rouse themselves.
"Saffron. From India."
A pause, and then Cobb laughs.
"Good airlift product. I should have thought of that."
"Ideal for a dirigible. Low weight. More profitable than opium on the uplift," Coyle says. "The kingdom still hasn't figured out how to crack the seed stock, and all the politicians and generals want it for their household kitchens. Lots of face if they can get it. I had solid pre-orders. I was going to be rich. Unbelievably rich."
"Are you ruined then?"
"Maybe not. I'm negotiating with Sri Ganesha Insurance. They might cover some."
Coyle shrugs.
"Well, 80%. But all the bribes to get into the country? All the payoffs to the customs agents?" He makes a face. "That's a complete loss. Still, I might get out with my skin. In a way, I got lucky. The shipment only falls under insurance guidelines because we're still on Carlisle's dirigible. I'd have toast that damn pilot for getting himself drowned in the ocean. If they'd unloaded the cargo and the white shirts had burned it on the ground, it would have been classified contraband. Then I'd be out there on the street with the far-gone beggars and the yellow carts."
Otto scowls.
"That's about the only thing to be said for Carlisle. If he wasn't so interested in touching politics, none of this would have happened."
Coyle shrugs.
"We don't know that."
"It's damn certain,"
Lucy interjects.
"Carlisle spends half his energy complaining about the white shirts and the other half cozying up with Akarat. It's a message from General Pracha to Carlisle and the Trade Ministry. We're just the carrier pigeons."
"Carrier pigeons are extinct."
"You think we won't be? General Pracha would be happy to throw every one of us into Klong Prem prison if he thought it would send the right message to Akarat."
Her gaze swings to Anderson.
"You're awfully quiet, Lake. You didn't lose anything at all?"
Anderson stirs himself.
"Manufacturing materials. Replacement parts for my line. Probably 150,000 bluebills. My secretary's still evaluating the damage."
He glances at Coyle. "Our stuff was on the ground. No insurance." The memory of his conversation with Hak Sung is still fresh. Hak Sung first played a denial, complaining of incompetence at the anchor pads, before finally confessing that everything was lost, and that he had failed to pay all the bribe money in the first place. An ugly confessional, almost hysterical, the old man terrified of losing his job, and Anderson pressing him further and further into his fear, humiliating him and shouting at him, making the old man cower, making a point of his displeasure. Still, he can't help wondering if the lesson has been learned, or if Hak Sung will try to be tricky again. Anderson grimaces. If the old man didn't free up so much of Anderson's time for more important work, he'd ship the old bastard back to the yellow card towers.
"I told you this was a stupid place to run a factory," Lucy says.
"The Japanese do it."
"Only because they have special arrangements with the palace."
"The Chaozhou Chinese do just fine, too,"
Lucy makes a face.
They've been here for generations. Practically Thai at this point. We're more like yellow cards than Chow Joe, if you want to make comparisons. A smart Farahang knows not to keep too much invested in this place. The ground's always shifting. It's too damn easy to lose everything in a crackdown, or another coup.
We all work with the hands we're dealt.
Anderson shrugs.
Anyway, Yates chose the site.
I told Yates it was stupid, too.
Anderson recalls Yates, eyes bright with the possibilities of a new global economy.
Maybe not stupid, but definitely an idealist.
He finishes his drink.
The bar owner is nowhere in sight. He waves for the waiters, who all ignore him. One of them, at least, is asleep, standing.
You're not worried you'll get yanked the way Yates did?
Lucy asks.
Anderson shrugs. Wouldn't be the worst thing that could happen.
It's damn hot.
He touches his sunburned nose.
I'm more of a northern waste sort.
Wen and Coyle, dark-skinned both, laugh at that. But Otto just nods grimly. His own peeling nose, a testament to his inability to adapt to the burn of the equatorial sun. Lucy pulls out a pipe and pushes a couple of flies away before setting down her smoking tools and an accompanying ball of opium. The flies hobble away, but don't take to the air. Even the bugs seem stunned by the heat.
Down an alley near the rubble of an old expansion tower, children are playing next to a fresh water pump. Lucy watches them as she tamps her pipe.
Christ, I wish I was a kid again.
Everyone seems to have lost the energy for conversation. Anderson pulls the sack of gnaw out from between his feet, takes one out and peels it, pries the translucent fruit from the gnaw's interior, and tosses the hairy, hollow rind on the table, pops the fruit into his mouth.
Otto cocks his head, curious.
What's that you've got?
Anderson digs more out of his sack, distributes them.
Not sure. Thais call them gnaw.
Lucy stops tamping her pipe.
I've seen them. They're all over the market. They don't have blister rust?
Anderson shakes his head.
Not so far. The lady who sold them said they were clean. Had the certificates.
Everyone laughs, but Anderson shrugs off their cynicism.
I let them sit for a week. Nothing. They're cleaner than Utex.
The others follow his lead and eat their own fruits. Eyes widen. Smiles appear. Anderson opens the sack wide and sets it on the table.
Go ahead. I've been eating too many as it is.
They all rifle the bag. A pile of rinds grows in the center of the table. Coyle chews thoughtfully.
It sort of reminds me of lychee.
Oh?
Anderson controls his interest.
Never heard of it.
Sure. I had a drink that tasted a bit like it last time I was in India, Kolkata. A Percal sales rep took me to one of his restaurants when I first started looking at shipping saffron.
So you think it's this lychee?
Could be. Lychee was what he called the drink. Might not have been the fruit at all.
If it's a Percal product, I don't see how it would show up here.
Lucy says, these should all be out on Koh Angret, under quarantine, while the Environment Ministry finds 10,000 different ways to tax the thing.
She spits the pit into her palm and tosses it off the balcony into the street.
I'm seeing these everywhere. They've got to be local.
She reaches into the sack and takes another.
You know who might know about them, though.
She leans back and calls into the dimness of the bar.
Hag! You still there? You awake back in there?
At the man's name, the others stir and try to straighten themselves, like children caught by a strict parent. Anderson forces down an instinctive chill.
I wish you hadn't done that,
he mutters. Otto grimaces.
I thought he died.
Blister Rust never gets the chosen ones, don't you know? Everyone stifles a laugh as a form shambles out of the gloom. Hag's face is flushed, and sweat speckles his face. He surveys the phalanx solemnly.
Hello, all.
He nods his head to Lucy.
Still trafficking with these sort, then?
Lucy shrugs.
I make do.
She nods at a chair.
Don't just stand there, have a drink on us. Tell us your stories.
She lights her opium pipe and draws on it as the man pulls up the chair beside her and sags into it. Hag is a solid man, well-fleshed. Not for the first time, Anderson thinks how interesting it is that Grahamite priests of all their flock are always the ones whose waistlines overflow their niche. Hag waves for whiskey and surprises everyone when a waiter appears at his elbow almost immediately.
No ice,
the waiter says on arrival.
No. No ice, of course not.
Hag shakes his head emphatically.
Don't want the damn calories spent anyway.
When the waiter returns, Hag takes the drink and downs it instantly, then sends the waiter back for a second.
It's good to be back in from the countryside, he says. You start missing the pleasures of civilization.
He toasts them all with a second glass and downs it as well.
How far out were you?
Lucy asks around the pipe clamped in her teeth. She's starting to look a little glassy from the burning tar.
Near the old border with Burma, 3 pagodas pass.
He looks sourly at them all as if they're guilty of the sins he researches.
Looking into ivory beetle spread.
Not safe up there, I heard,
Otto says.
Who's the Jaupo? A man named Chanarang, and he was no trouble at all. Far easier to work with than the Dung Lord or any of the small Jaupo in the city. Not all the godfathers are so focused on profits and power.
Hag looks back pointedly.
For those of us who aren't interested in pillaging the kingdom of coal or jade or opium, the countryside is safe enough. He shrugs. In any case, I was invited by Pra Kritipong to visit his monastery, to observe the changes in ivory beetle behavior.
He shakes his head.
The devastation is extraordinary. Whole forests with not a leaf on them. Kudzu and nothing else. The entire overstory is gone, timber fallen everywhere.
Otto looks interested.
Anything salvageable?
Lucy gives him a look of disgust.
It's ivory beetle, you idiot. No one around here wants that.
Anderson asks,
you say the monastery invited you up, even though you're a Grahamite.
Pra Kritipong is enlightened enough to know that neither Jesus Christ nor the niche teachings are anathema to his kind. Buddhist and Grahamite values overlap in many areas. Noah and the martyr Prasub are entirely complementary figures.
Anderson stifles a laugh.
If your monk saw how Grahamites operate back home, he might see it differently.
Hag looks offended.
I am not some preacher of field burnings. I am a scientist.
Didn't mean any offense.
Anderson pulls out a gnaw and offers it to Hag.
This might interest you. We just found them in the market.
Hag eyes the gnaw, surprised.
The market?
Which one?
All over. Lucy supplies.
They showed up while you were gone.
Anderson says. Try it. They're not bad. Hag takes the fruit, studying it closely.
Extraordinary. Do you know what they are?
Otto asks. Anderson peels another fruit for himself, but even as he does, he listens closely. He would never directly ask the question of a Grahamite, but he's perfectly willing to let others do the work.
Coyle thought it was a lychee, Lucy says. Is he right?
No, not a lychee, that's for certain.
Hag turns it in his hand.
It looks like it could be something the old texts called a rambutan.
Hag is thoughtful.
Though, if I recall correctly, they're somewhat related.
Rambutan? Anderson keeps his expression friendly and neutral. That's a funny name. The Thais all call them Ngaw. Hag eats the fruit, spits the fat pit into his palm, examines the black seed, wet with his saliva.
I wonder if it will breed true.
You could put it in a flower pot and find out.
Hag gives him an irritated look.
If it doesn't come from a calorie company, it will breed. The Thais don't make sterile gene rips.
Anderson laughs.
I didn't think the calorie companies made tropical fruits.
They make pineapples.
Right. Forgot.
Anderson waits.
How do you know so much about fruits?
I studied biosystems and ecology at Alabama New University.
That's your Grahamite college, right? I thought all you studied was how to start a field burning.
The others suck in their breath at the provocation, but Hag just looks back coldly.
Don't bait me. I'm not that sort. If we're ever going to restore Eden, it will take the knowledge of ages to accomplish it. Before I came over, I spent a year immersed in pre-contraction Southeast Asia ecosystems.
He reaches across and takes another fruit.
This must gall the calorie companies.
Lucy fumbles for another fruit.
You think we could fill a clipper ship with these and send them back across the water? You know, play a calorie company in reverse? People would pay a fortune for them, I'll bet. New flavor and all? Sell it as a luxury.
Otto shakes his head.
You'd have to convince them it's not blister rust tainted. The red skin will make people nervous.
Hag nods agreement.
It's a route best not pursued.
But the calorie companies do it, Lucy points out. They ship seeds and foods wherever they want. They're global. Why shouldn't we try the same?
Because it goes against all the niche teachings.
Hag says gently,
the calorie companies have already earned their place in hell. There's no reason you should be eager to join them.
Anderson laughs.
Come on, Hag. You can't seriously be against a little entrepreneurial spirit.
Lucy's onto something. We could even put your face on the side of the crates.
He makes a sign of Grahamite blessing.
You know, approved by the Holy Church and all that. Safe as soy pro.
He grins.
What do you think of that?
I would never participate in such blasphemy.
Hag scowls.
Food should come from the place of its origin and stay there. It shouldn't spend its time crisscrossing the globe for the sake of profit. We went down that path once, and it brought us to ruin.
More niche teachings. Anderson peels another fruit.
There must be a niche for money somewhere in Grahamite orthodoxy. Your cardinals are fat enough.
The teachings are sound, even if the flock strays.
Hag stands abruptly.
Thank you for the company.
He frowns at Anderson, but reaches across the table and grabs one more fruit before stalking away. As soon as he's gone, everyone relaxes.
Christ, Lucy, why'd you do that? Otto asks. That man creeps me out. I left the compact so I could get away from Grahamite priests looking over my shoulder, and you have to call one over.
Coyle nods morosely.
I heard there's another priest here at the Joint Embassy now.
They're everywhere. Like maggots.
Lucy waves at them.
Toss me another fruit.
They return to their gorging. Anderson watches them, curious to see if these well-traveled creatures will have any other ideas about its provenance. The rambutan is an interesting possibility, though. Already, despite the bad news about the destroyed algae tanks and nutrient cultures, the day is turning out better than expected. Rambutan. A word to send back to Des Moines and the researchers. A route of investigation into the origins of this mysterious botanic object. Somewhere, there will be a historical record of it. He'll have to go back to his books and see if he can find...
Look who's here, Coyle mutters.
Everyone turns. Richard Carlyle, in a perfectly pressed linen suit, is climbing the stairs. He takes off his hat as he reaches the shade, fanning himself.
I fucking hate that man,
Lucy mutters. She lights another pipe, draws hard.
What's he smiling about?
Otto asks.
Hell if I know. He lost a dirigible, didn't he?
Carlyle pauses in the shade, scans the patrons across the room, nods at all of them.
Pretty hot one, he calls out.
Otto stares at him, red-faced and bullet-eyed, and mutters,
If it hadn't been for his fucking politicking, I'd be a rich man today.
Don't be dramatic.
Anderson pops another gnaw into his mouth.
Lucy, give the man a puff of your pipe.
I don't feel like having Sir Francis kick us out into the heat for brawling.
Lucy's eyes have gone glassy with opium, but she waves the pipe in Otto's general direction. Anderson reaches across and plucks it from her fingers and gives it to Otto, before standing and picking up his empty glass.
Anyone else want something?
Desultory shakes of the head. Carlyle grins as he arrives at the bar.
You get poor old Otto sorted out?
Anderson glances back. Lucy smokes serious opium. I doubt he'll be able to walk, let alone find anyone.
Devil's drug, that.
Anderson toasts him with his empty glass.
That and booze.
He peers over the edge of the bar. Where the hell's Sir Francis?
I thought you were here to answer that question.
I guess not, Anderson says. You lose much?
Some.
Really? You don't seem bothered. Anderson gestures back at the rest of the phalanx. Everyone else is pissing and moaning about how you keep interfering with politics, cozying up with Akarat and the Trade Ministry. But here you are smiling ear to ear. You could be a tie. Carlyle shrugs. Sir Francis, elegantly dressed, carefully coiffed, emerges from a back room. Carlyle asks for whiskey and Anderson holds up his own empty glass.
No ice,
Sir Francis says.
The Muley men want more money to run the pump.
Pay them, then. Sir Francis shakes his head as he takes Anderson's glass.
If you bargain when they squeeze your balls, they will only squeeze again.
and I cannot bribe the Environment Ministry to give me access to the coal grid like your Farang.
He turns away and pulls down a bottle of Khmer whiskey, pours an immaculate shot. Anderson wonders if any of the rumors about the man are true.
Otto, now mumbling incoherently about fugging dribbles, claims that Sir Francis was an old Chao Phraya, a high assistant to the crown, forced out of the palace in a power play. This theory has as much merit as the idea that he is a former servant of the Dung Lord, retired, or that he is a Khmer prince, displaced and living incognito ever since the Thai kingdom was enlarged to swallow the East. Everyone agrees he must have been of high rank. It's the only thing that explains his disdain for his patrons.
"Pay now," he says, as he sets the shots on the bar.
Carlyle laughs.
"You know our credit's good."
Sir Francis shakes his head.
"You both lost plenty at the anchor pads. Everyone knows it. Pay now."
Carlyle and Anderson shell out coins.
"I thought we had a better relationship than that," Anderson complains.
"This is politics,"
Sir Francis smiles.
"Maybe you are here tomorrow. Maybe you are swept away like expansion plastic on a beach. There are whisper sheets on all the street corners calling for Captain Jaidi to be made a Chao Phraya advisor to the palace. If he rises, then all you Farang..."
He makes a shooing motion with his hand.
"All gone."
He shrugs.
"General Pracha's radio stations are calling Jaidi a tiger and hero. And the student associations have been calling for the trade ministry to be closed down and placed under the white shirts. The trade ministry lost face. Farang and trade are close, like Farang and fleas."
"Nice."
Sir Francis shrugs.
"You do smell."
Carlyle scowls.
"Everyone smells. It's the goddamn hot season."
Anderson intercedes. "I suppose trade is seething, losing face like that." He takes a sip of the warm whiskey and grimaces. He used to like room temperature liquor before he came here. Sir Francis counts their coins into his cash box.
"Minister Akarat is still smiling, but the Japanese want reparations for their losses, and the white shirts will never give them. So either Akarat will pay to make up for what the Tiger of Bangkok has done, or he will lose face to the Japanese as well."
"You think the Japanese will leave?"
Sir Francis makes a face of disgust.
"The Japanese are like the calorie companies, always looking for a way in. They will never go away."
He moves to the other end of the bar, leaving them once again isolated. Anderson pulls out a ngaw and offers it to Carlyle.
"Want one?"
Carlyle takes the fruit and holds it up for examination.
"What the hell is this?"
"Ngaw.
It reminds me of cockroaches."
He makes a face.
"You're an experimental bastard, I'll give you that."
He pushes the ngaw back across to Anderson and carefully wipes his hand on his trousers.
"Afraid?"
Anderson goads.
"My wife liked eating new things, too. Couldn't stop herself. Had the madness for flavor. Just couldn't resist trying new foods."
Carlyle shrugs.
"I'll wait and see if you're spitting up blood next week."
They lean back on their stools and gaze across the dust and heat to where the Victory Hotel gleams white. Down an alley, a washing woman has set out laundry in pans near the rubble of an old high-rise. Another is washing her body, carefully scrubbing under her sarong, its fabric clinging to her skin. Children run naked through the dirt, jumping over bits of broken concrete that were laid down more than 100 years ago in the old expansion. Far down the street, the levees rise, holding back the sea. How much did you lose? Carlisle finally asks. Plenty, thanks to you. Carlisle doesn't respond to the jab. He finishes his shot and waves for another.
Really no ice?
He asks Sir Francis.
Or is this just because you think we'll be gone tomorrow?
Ask me tomorrow.
If I'm still here tomorrow, will you have ice then?
Carlisle asks. Sir Francis flashes a grin.
Depends how much you keep paying muleys and megadons for unloading freight. Everyone talks about getting rich burning calories for Farang. So no ice for Sir Francis.
But if we're gone, no drinkers. Even if Sir Francis has got all the ice in the world.
Sir Francis shrugs.
As you say.
Carlisle scowls at the Thai man's back.
Megadont unions, white shirts, Sir Francis. Everywhere you turn, there's another open hand.
Price of doing business, Anderson says. Still, the way you were smiling when you came in, I thought you hadn't lost anything at all. Carlisle takes his new whiskey.
I just like seeing all of you on the veranda, looking like your dogs died from cystoscosis. Anyway, even if we've had losses, no one's chained us in a Klong Prem sweat cell. No reason not to smile about that.
He leans close.
This isn't the last of the story. Not by a long shot. Akarat still got some tricks up his sleeve.
If you push hard enough on the white shirts, they always bite back. Anderson warns. You and Akarat made a lot of noise, talking about tariff and pollution credit changes. Wind-ups, even. And now my assistant is telling me the same things that Sir Francis just said. All the Thai newspapers are calling our friend Jaidi a Queen's Tiger. Celebrating him.
Your assistant. You mean that paranoid yellow card spider you keep in your offices?
Carlisle laughs.
That's the problem with you. You all sit around bitching and wishing, and meanwhile, I'm changing the rules of the game. You're all contraction thinkers.
I'm not the one who lost the dirigible.
Cost of doing business.
I'd think losing a fifth of your fleet would be more than just a cost. Carlisle makes a face.
He leans closer and lowers his voice. Come on, Anderson. This tiff with the white shirts isn't what it seems. Some people have been waiting for them to go too far.
He pauses, making sure his words are understood.
Some of us have been working toward it even. I've just come from speaking with Akarat himself, and I can assure you the news is about to turn in our favor.
Anderson almost laughs, but Carlisle wags an admonishing finger.
Go ahead, shake your head now, but before I'm done, you'll be kissing my ass and thanking me for the new tariff structures, and we'll all have reparations in our bank accounts. The white shirts never pay reparations. Not when they burn a farm. Not when they confiscate a cargo. Never.
Carlisle shrugs. He looks out toward the hot light of the veranda and observes.
The monsoons are coming.
Not likely. Anderson gives the blazing day a sour look. They're already late by 2 months.
Oh, they're coming, all right. Maybe not this month. Maybe not next. But they're coming.
And? The Environment Ministry is expecting replacement equipment for the city's levee pumps. Critical equipment. For 7 pumps. He pauses. Now where do you think that equipment is sitting?
Enlighten me.
All the way across the Indian Ocean. Carlyle flashes a sudden shark-like smile. In a certain Calcutta hangar that I happen to own. The air seems to have left the bar. Anderson glances around, making sure no one is close. Christ, you silly bastard, are you serious? It all makes sense now. Carlyle's bragging his certainty. The man has always had a freebooter's willingness to take risks, but it's difficult to distinguish bluster from sincerity with Carlyle. If he says he has Akarat's ear, perhaps he only speaks with secretaries. It's all talk, but this... Anderson starts to speak, but sees Sir Francis approaching and turns away instead, grimacing. Carlyle's eyes sparkle with mischief. Sir Francis sets a new whiskey behind his hand, but Anderson doesn't care about drinks anymore. As soon as Sir Francis retreats, he leans forward.
You're holding the city hostage.
The white shirts seem to have forgotten they need outsiders. We're in the middle of a new expansion, and every string is connected to every other string. And yet, they're still thinking like a contraction ministry. They don't understand how dependent they've already become on Farang. He shrugs. At this point, they're just pawns on a chessboard. They have no idea who moves them, and couldn't stop us even if they tried. He tosses back another shot of whiskey, grimaces, and slaps it down on the bar.
We should all send flowers to that Jaidi white-shirt bastard. He's done his job perfectly. With half the city's coal pumps offline,
he shrugs.
The nice thing about dealing with the Thais is that they're really a very sensitive people.
I won't even have to make a threat. They'll figure it out all on their own and make things right.
Quite a gamble. Isn't everything?
Carlyle favors Anderson with a cynical smile. Maybe we're all dead tomorrow from a blister rust rewrite. Or maybe we're the richest men in the kingdom. It's all a gamble. The Thais play for keeps. So should we.
I just put a spring gun to your head and trade your brains for the pumps.
That's the spirit.
Carlyle laughs.
Now you're thinking like a Thai.
But I've got myself covered there, too.
What, with the trade ministry?
Anderson makes a face. Akarat doesn't have the muscle to protect you.
Better than that. He's got generals.
You're drunk.
General Prosh's friends run every part of the military. The only reason the white shirts don't run the entire country already is because the old king stepped in before Prosh could squash Akarat the last time.
Times change.
Prosh's white shirts and his payoffs made a lot of people angry.
People want to change.
You're talking revolution now.
Is it revolution if the palace asks for it?
Carlyle reaches nonchalantly across the bar for the bottle of whiskey and pours. He upends it and gets less than half a shot from the bottle. He raises an eyebrow to Anderson.
Ah, now you're paying attention.
He points to Anderson's tumbler. Are you going to drink that?
How far does this go?
You want in on the deal?
Why would you offer?
You have to ask.
Carlyle shrugs.
When Yates set up your factory, he tripled the Megadont Union's fees for jewels, threw money everywhere. Hard not to notice that kind of funding.
He nods at the other expatriates, now playing a listless game of poker and waiting for the heat of the day to abate, so that they can go on with their work, or their whoring, or their passive wait for the next day. Everyone else, they're children. Little kids wearing adult clothes. You're different. You think we're rich? Oh, stop the theatrics. My dirigibles haul your cargo. Carlyle regards him. I've seen where your supply shipments originate from. He looks at Anderson significantly. Before they arrive in Calcutta. Anderson pretends nonchalance. So? An awful lot of material coming from Des Moines. You think I'm worth talking to because I've got Midwestern investors? Doesn't everyone get their investors where the money is? So what if a rich widow wants to experiment with King Springs? You read too much into small things. Do I? Carlyle looks around the bar and leans close. People are talking about you. How so? They say you're quite interested in seeds. He looks significantly at the rind of the gnaw between them. We're all gene spotters these days. But you're the only one who pays for your intelligence. The only one who asks about white shirts and gene rippers. Anderson smiles coldly. You've been talking to Raleigh. Carlyle inclines his head. If it's any consolation, it wasn't easy. He didn't want to talk about you. Not at all. He should have thought a little harder. He can't get his aging treatments without me. Carlyle shrugs. We have shipping representatives in Japan. You weren't offering him another decade of easy living. Anderson forces a laugh. Of course. He smiles, but inside he is seething. He'll have to deal with Raleigh. And now perhaps Carlyle as well. He's been sloppy. He eyes the gnaw with disgust. He's been waving his latest interest in front of everyone. Grahamites even, and now this. It's too easy to get comfortable. To forget all the lines of exposure. And then one day in a bar, someone slaps you in the face. Carlyle is saying, if I could just speak with certain people, discuss certain propositions. He trails off, brown eyes hunting for a sign of agreement in Anderson's expression. I don't care which company you're working for. If I understand your interests correctly, then we might find our goals lie in similar directions. Anderson drums his fingers on the bar. Thoughtful. If Carlyle were to disappear, would it rouse any interest at all? He might even be able to blame it on overzealous white shirts. You think you've got a chance? Anderson asks. It wouldn't be the first time the Thais have reformed their government with force. The Victory Hotel wouldn't exist if Prime Minister Surawang hadn't lost his head and his mansion in the December 12th coup. Thai history is littered with changes in administration. I'm a little concerned that if you're talking to me, you're talking to others. Maybe too many others. Who else would I talk to? Carlyle jerks his head toward the rest of the Farang phalanx. They're nothing. Wouldn't consider them for a second. Your people, though. Carlyle trails off, considering his words, then leans forward. Look, Akarat has some experience with these matters. The white shirts have created a number of enemies. And not just Farang. All our project requires is a bit of help, gathering momentum. He takes a sip of his whiskey. Considers the taste for a moment before setting the glass down. The consequences would be quite favorable for us if it succeeds.
He locks eyes with Anderson.
Quite favorable for you, for your friends in the Midwest.
What do you get out of it?
Trade, of course.
Carlyle grins.
If the ties face outward instead of living in this absurd defensive crouch of theirs, my company expands. It's just good business. I can't imagine that your people enjoy cooling their heels on Co-Angrit, begging to be allowed to sell a few tons of Utex or Soy Pro to the kingdom when there's a crop failure. You could have free trade instead of sitting out on that quarantine island. I'd think that would be attractive to you. It certainly would benefit me.
Anderson studies Carlyle, trying to decide how much to trust the man. For 2 years they have drunk together, have whored occasionally, have closed shipping contracts on a handshake, but Anderson knows only a little about him. The Home Office has a portfolio, but it's thin. Anderson mulls. The seed bank is out there waiting. With a pliable government.
Which generals are backing you?
Carlyle laughs. If I told you that, you'd just think I was foolish and unable to keep secrets.
The man is all talk. Anderson decides. He'll have to make sure Carlyle disappears. Soon. Quietly. Before his cover gets blown.
It sounds interesting. Maybe we should meet to talk a little more about our mutual goals.
Carlyle opens his mouth to respond, then pauses, studying Anderson. He smiles and shakes his head.
Oh, no. You don't believe me.
He shrugs.
Fair enough.
Just wait, then. In 2 days' time, I think you'll be more impressed.
We'll talk then.
He looks significantly at Anderson.
And we'll talk at a place of my choosing.
He finishes his drink.
Why wait? What's going to change between now and then?
Carlyle settles his hat on his head and smiles.
Everything, my dear Farang. Everything.
Chapter 9. Emiko wakes to afternoon swelter. She stretches, breathing shallowly in the oven bake of her flyby.
There is a place for wind-ups.
The knowledge tingles within her. A reason to live. She presses a hand up against the weather-all planks that divide her sleeping slot from the one above. Touching the knots. Thinking of the last time she felt so content. Remembering Japan and the luxuries that Gendo-sama bequeathed. Her own flat. Climate control that blew cool through humid summer days, dangang fish that glowed and changed colors like chameleons, iridescent and changeable, dependent on their speed, blue slow fish, red fast ones. She used to tap the glass of their tank and watch them streak red through dark waters, their wind-up nature in brightest bloom. She too used to glow brightly. She was built well, trained well, knew the ways of pillow companion, secretary, translator, and observer, services for her master that she performed so admirably that he honored her like a dove and released her into the bright blue arc of the sky. She had been so honored. The weather-all knots stared down at her. The only decoration on the divider that separates her sleeping slot from the one above and keeps the garbage of her neighbors from raining down. Linseed reek billows off the wood.
nauseating in the Five Bys' hot confines. In Japan, there were rules about using such wood for human habitation. Here in the tower slums, no one cares. Emiko's lungs burn. She breathes shallowly, listening to the grunt and snore of the other bodies. No sound filters down from the slot above. Fuen Tai must not be back. Otherwise, she would have suffered already. Would have been kicked or fucked by now. It's not often that she survives a whole day without abuse. Fuen Tai is not yet home. Perhaps he is dead. The fagon fringe on his neck was certainly thick enough the last time she saw him. She squirms out of her slot and straightens in the narrow gap between the Five By and the door. Stretches again, then reaches in and fumbles for her plastic bottle, yellowed and thinned with age. Drinks blood-warm water. She swallows convulsively, wishing she had ice. Two flights up, a splintered door gives way and she spills out onto the roof. Sunlight and heat envelop her. Even with the sun hammering down, it is cooler than her Five By. All around her, clotheslines draped with rustling pasin and trousers rustle in the sea breeze. The sun is sinking, glistening from the tips of Watts and Chedi. The water of the Glongs and the Chao Phraya glistens. Kink spring skiffs and trimaran clipper ships glide across red mirrors. To the north, the distance is lost in the orange haze of dung burn and humidity. But somewhere out there, if the pale-scarred Farang is to be believed, wind-ups dwell. Somewhere beyond the armies that war for shares of coal and jade and opium, her own lost tribe awaits her. She was never Japanese. She was only ever a wind-up. And now, her true clan awaits her. If only she can find a way. She stares north a moment longer, hungering, then goes to the bucket she stowed the night before. There is no water on the upper levels, no pressure to reach so high, and she cannot risk bathing at the public pumps. So every night, she struggles up the stairs with her water bucket and leaves it here in anticipation of the day. In the privacy of the open air and the setting sun, she bathes. It is a ritual process, a careful cleansing. The bucket of water, a fingerling of soap. She squats beside the bucket and ladles the warm water over herself. It is a precise thing, a scripted act as deliberate as Jonomai, each move choreographed. A worship of scarcity. She pours a ladleful over her head. Water courses down her face, runs over breasts and ribs and thighs, trickles onto hot concrete. Another ladleful, soaking her black hair, coursing down her spine and curling around her buttocks. Again a ladle of water, sheeting over her skin like mercury. And then the soap, rubbing it into her hair and then her skin, scouring herself of the previous night's insults until she wears a pale sheen of suds. And again the bucket and ladle, rinsing herself as carefully as with the first wetting. Water sluices away soap and grime. Even some of the shame comes with it. If she were to scrub for 1,000 years, she would not be clean. But she is too tired to care, and she has grown accustomed to scars she cannot scour away. The sweat, the alcohol, the humid salt of semen and degradation. These she can cleanse. It is enough. She is too tired to scrub harder. Too hot and too tired. Always. At the end of her rinsing, she is happy to find a little water left in the bucket. She dips one ladle full and drinks it, gulping, And then, in a wasteful, unrestrained gesture, she upends the bucket over her head in one glorious cathartic rush. In that moment, between the touch of the water and the splash as it pools around her toes, she is clean. Out on the streets, she tries to blend into the daylight street activity. Mizumi-sensei trained her to walk in certain ways, to accent and make beautiful the stutter motion of her body. But if Emiko is very careful and fights her nature and training, if she wears pasin and does not swing her arms, she almost passes. Along the sidewalks, seamstresses lounge beside treadle sewing machines, waiting for evening trade. Snack sellers stack the remains of their wares in tidy piles, awaiting the day's final shoppers. Night market food stalls are setting out little bamboo stools and tables in the street, the ritual encroachment on the thoroughfares that signals the end of day and the beginning of life in a tropic city. Emiko tries not to stare. It's been a long time since she risked walking streets in daylight. When Raleigh acquired her 5x, he gave her strict instructions. He could not keep her in Planchette itself. Even whores and pimps and drug addicts had limits, so he installed her in a slum where bribes were cheaper and the neighbors were not so picky about the neighboring offal. But his instructions were strict. Walk only at night. Keep to shadows. Come directly to the club and return directly home. Anything else? And there was little hope of survival. Her nape prickles as she makes her way through the daylit crowds. Most of these people will not care about her. The benefit of the daytime is that people are far too busy with their own lives to worry about a creature like her, even if they catch sight of her odd movements. In the deep night of green methane flicker, there are fewer eyes, but they are idle ones, high on yaba or laulau. Eyes with the time and opportunity to pursue. A woman selling Environment Ministry certified sticks of sliced papaya watches her suspiciously. Emiko forces herself not to panic. She continues down the street with her mincing steps, trying to convince herself that she appears eccentric rather than genetically transgressive. Her heart pounds against her ribs.
Too fast. Slow down. You have time. Not so much as you would like, but still enough to ask questions. Slowly, patiently. Do not betray yourself. Do not overheat.
Her palms are wet with sweat, the only part of her body that ever really feels cool. She keeps them open, wide like fans, trying to absorb comfort. She pauses at a public pump to splash water on her skin and drink deep, glad that new people fear little in the way of bacterial or parasitic infection. She is an inhospitable host. That, at least, is benefit. If she were not a new person, she would simply strut into Walampong railway station and purchase a ticket on a Kingspring train, ride it as far as the wastes of Chiang Mai, and then proceed into the wilderness. It would be easy. Instead, she must be clever. The roads will be guarded. Anything that leads to the northeast and the Mekong will be clogged with military personnel transferring between the eastern front and the capital. A new person would excite attention, particularly given that new people military models sometimes fight on behalf of the Vietnamese. But there is another way. From her time with Gendo-sama, she remembers that much of the kingdom's freight moves by river. Emiko turns down Tanong Mongkok toward the docks and levees and stops short. White shirts. She cringes against a wall as the pair stalks past. They don't even look at her. She blends if she does not move, but still, as soon as they are out of sight, she has the urge to scuttle back to her tower. Most of the white shirts there have been bribed. These ones... She shivers. At last, The Gaijin warehouses and trading stations rise before her, the newly built commercial blocks. She makes her way up the seawall. At its top, the ocean spreads before her.